Thanks for having me once again. So always a privilege. So tonight we're going to ask the question, who is Jesus? Or who was Jesus? Who was Jesus or who is Jesus? Well, the question you ask will depend on how you answer the question, I suppose. Ask the average English person, who was Jesus? And you're likely to get mixed responses, I would imagine. I think we would say that generally in this country there's a certain bag of answers that people tend to reach for when answering the question, who is Jesus, who was Jesus? And I think probably you might disagree with me, but in my experience, the by far the most common answer that people tend to give to this question is Jesus was a good man. Perhaps something along those lines. He was a teacher who wandered around Palestine teaching a message of love and compassion. He had a magnetic personality, and his teachings were perhaps a contrast to the religious ideas of the day, which got him into trouble. Some would even go so far as to say he was a prophet in some sense. And others would probably say, we don't really know who he was. The true Jesus, whoever he was, has been lost in the mists of time. And I wonder what your position is on that, how you would answer that question as we start tonight. Well, this modern view that I'm going to call it is definitely a contrast to what Jesus' own followers always believed about him and what Christianity has always taught. Here are some excerpts from parts of the Bible which address the same question, who is Jesus? So Colossians 1:15, this is the Apostle Paul, says he is the image of the invisible God. Next one, thanks. Hebrews 1:3 says the Son, that's Jesus, is the radiance of God's glory and the exact representation of his being, sustaining all things by his powerful word. Actually, I've just been really struck by this verse just this week as I was walking. I was walking in Wild Park too, and just thinking, wow, thank you, Jesus, for holding the whole universe together at every moment, but also holding our relationships together, holding our personalities together, sustaining all things. He's so comprehensive by his powerful word. John 1:1 says, in the beginning was the Word, that's Jesus again, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. So that's quite different to the view of Jesus as a good man, merely a good man. So from the beginning, we have this fact that our culture views Jesus in one way, and the Christian church has always viewed him in a radically, almost unspeakably different way, as God in human flesh, the creator of the universe, and the way to know God personally. And that's quite a big difference. And I guess my approach tonight is going to be, I'm going to be speaking as if you're not convinced by any of these things, as if you hold the view that I outlined, that modern society, most people take, that Jesus was merely a good man. So I'm going to be assuming that, and hopefully you'll find it interesting. Let's just break that view down again. I think there are two ways to state this view, that Jesus was merely a good man. I think I would call it the legend view and the conspiracy view. Probably have some idea what I mean. The legend view is that Jesus was a wise sage or a teacher and had a profound impact on his followers, and maybe his spirit and his memory of his teachings lived on. And as people spoke about him after his death, these stories were circulated more and more widely. And gradually, as time went on, the stories began to be embellished, and exaggerated in the most well-meaning way, of course. So the man who taught the crowds to share eventually became the man who fed 5,000 people with just 5 loaves of bread. Or the man who cared for the sick eventually became the man who healed the sick, and so on. The stories gradually, as they get passed down the generations, became more and more exaggerated. Things became so out of hand that some people even began to talk about him being divine. And the real man, Jesus, became the God-man of legend. This is overwhelmingly the view that you'll hear from most academics, most TV programs, most people on the street. Or you might hear the conspiracy view. I don't know, has anyone read The Da Vinci Code? You know, this idea that hundreds of years after Jesus' death, it became somehow politically expedient in order to control the masses for the church fathers to construct a view of Jesus as a divine figure, when in fact Jesus himself would never have thought of such a thing. It was just a political ruse. There should be a picture. Yeah, this is my attempt to find a sort of picture of a shady looking church council kind of wheeler dealing kind of, they don't look very trustworthy. Okay, so I'm going to look at those two views and ask the question, is this reasonable? Can we, as thinking people, hold these views? Is this going to hold water? I think before we go into that, one thing that's common to these views is that belief in Jesus as God is a human creation. And perhaps it's even a comfortable crutch which helps us Christians to get through life. You know, it's nice to think that there's someone out there looking after us. It's nice to think that God has revealed himself. But really, you know, it's just a comfortable fiction. The reality is that we can't really know who Jesus was, or if we can, it's certainly not what the church claims. Human beings have constructed this idea of Jesus as God as a comfortable fable. I'm going to come back to that idea later. Okay. Let's look at the historical evidence and see what we can say about Jesus from a historical perspective. The first doubt about the historical evidence I'm going to bring is that idea of the legend. Let's think about the Bible. A lot of people might be worried or have a concern that the Bible has been changed. So maybe it was originally written, as we said, describing the actions of a good teacher, and maybe gradually as it was passed on, changes were made, or maybe people added bits and so on to kind of spice it up a little bit and eventually came up with this idea of Jesus as God. Is this a credible position? Well, actually, this view is completely discredited. No serious scholar actually holds this. In modern scholarship, no one doubts that what we have in our Bibles is exactly, almost exactly, what the original authors wrote. Okay. In fact, there's a branch of scholarship called textual criticism that's been able to establish that our text that we have in our Bibles is 99% accurate to the original manuscripts that were written by the original authors. You might say that's a bold claim. The reason we're able to say this so confidently is to do with the sheer number of manuscripts of the New Testament that have survived to the present day. And I've got a helpful chart here. This shows, you can see at the bottom, you can see the number of manuscripts of the New Testament that we have in existence, which you can actually see in places like the British Museum. And here are some works, some other ancient texts, and you can see the difference. So Herodotus, who wrote in who was around in 488 BC, we have 8 copies, 8 surviving, 8 manuscripts of this work. And scholars usually consider that to be plenty. So if there had been any change along the way, if anything had changed in one of the traditions of manuscript copying, we'd be able to tell from the other 7 and work out which was the true rendering. If you compare that to the New Testament, we have 5,000 Greek manuscripts, and not to mention 10,000 Latin and 9,300 others. What this means is that if at some point in history someone decided to change part of a document, could we see the next slide? Thanks, Warren. So say somebody decides to make an alteration here to maybe spice up the story. Well, we would know that that had happened because we have so many others to compare it to. So there's absolutely no way that the text of the New Testament could have been changed without people realizing it, given the sheer number of manuscripts we have. This also negates the view that the church councils in the 4th century may have changed the meaning of the text. Because, well, for one reason, from what I just said, if they had done so, it would be very easy to spot. But also, we have existing manuscripts from before the church councils. So we have complete copy. Yes, we can see that slide, please. You can see this is from this book, The New Testament Documents, Are They Reliable? By F.F. Bruce. You see we have a complete, or the most of the New Testament by A.D. 250. The church councils didn't happen until the 4th century A.D. And the complete New Testament, we have an existing manuscript from 325 A.D. So this idea of the church councils altering the New Testament or inventing a Jesus is completely fictitious. Okay. So we've seen that the New Testament has been preserved in its original form. I hope that's convincing. But when was it originally written? After all, even if the documents weren't changed, perhaps they were legends in the first place. Stories about Jesus may be handed down through the generations orally, gradually became changed, and then finally written down. Sort of the Chinese whisper effect. And this is also a popular view today. And this might worry us. But what do the facts say? Well, there's a historian called A.N. Sherwin White, and he has written extensively on the subject of Roman society and Roman law in the New Testament. He's not a theologian, he's a historian. And he's done some research into how long it takes for legends to develop, looking at history. And he says that the sources that historians use are usually biased, usually removed by 1 or 2 centuries or generations from the events that they record. But even with these kinds of sources, historians reconstruct with confidence the course of Roman and Greek history. So even with sources which are 1 or 2 centuries after the event, historians are usually confident that this is historical fact. So, for example, the biographies of Alexander the Great were written 400 years after his death, and historians usually consider them to be trustworthy. And the legends about Alexander the Great did not develop, according to A.N. Sherwin White, until centuries following these biographies, so over 400 years later. And Sherwin White concludes that 2 generations is too short a lifespan to allow legendary tendencies to accumulate and wipe out the solid historical fact about an event or a figure. So the question is, what are the time spans in the New Testament? How long is it between the event, Jesus, and the time these things were written down? I think that's See the next chart. Thanks, Warren. I'm not sure if you can see that. Sorry if it's a bit unclear. Along the side, we've got the years. Yes. Reaching from AD 50, which is when Paul wrote the letter to the Thessalonians. So I remind you, Jesus died in around AD 30. So by AD 50, we have Paul's letters. By AD 70, we have Matthew, Mark, and Luke. And this is a liberal estimate. So this is the latest. This is what skeptics would say. I think Mark was written much earlier, and a lot of people do, but at the latest, Mark was written in the 70s. So that's a gap of some 40 years, and that's within the first generation of eyewitnesses. So the Gospels were written within the first generation. For the Gospels to be in their core legends, the rate of legendary accumulation would have to be, this is a quote from A.N. Sherwin White, unbelievable. And in fact, the earliest Christian documents aren't the Gospels, but the letters of Paul. So we've said that we can date Christian belief in Jesus as the radical Son of God to AD 50, but we can go even earlier than that. I won't go into it for time's sake. You can ask me later. We can actually get back to about 2 or 3 years after the crucifixion of Jesus. We know that this is what the original Christians believed. It's not a legend. It didn't build up over time. There's in fact no evidence whatsoever that would suggest that Christian belief in the resurrection of Jesus and his radical self-identity developed gradually over time. In the earliest writings and records, we see no trace of a merely good teacher, Jesus, becoming elevated to God status. All the evidence we have points firmly to the fact that belief in Jesus as the radical risen Son of God and Messiah exploded with great force from the very beginning of Christianity. It was this powerful conviction and unshakable belief that fueled the rapid growth of the church in Jerusalem. We can therefore be confident that belief in Jesus' resurrection and radical identity was not a legendary development. And I think this this whole question of who is Jesus is a bit like a suitcase, and you're trying to pack it for a holiday, and you're trying to put too much in. I don't know, I couldn't think of a good example, but have you ever had this experience where you kind of push it down on one side and then it comes up the other side, or you zip it up and it doesn't go, and then you try and push it in and then something breaks over here? I think this is the kind of situation we're dealing with. Every time we take an explanation for who is Jesus, we try to push him one way, something pops out again here. So we've said maybe he was, maybe the documents were changed, but we realize we can't do that, so we push it back in, but something pops out again. So maybe it was a legend in the first place, but we've seen that it can't have been, so we push it back in again. It pops out again here, and so we ask the question, well, if it was neither of those two things, maybe it was made up by the original apostles. Maybe it was just a tale that they made up. Perhaps a way to honor their master. He did predict that he would rise again. Perhaps they kind of made up the story that he was risen and that he was God as a way to further his memory. I think this is possible, but it's extremely unlikely for at least two reasons. Firstly, that we know from history, and nobody disputes this, that all but one of the original 12 apostles, the men who claimed to have seen with their own eyes Jesus alive after his resurrection, and would have been in a position to know for sure if that was true, all but one of them were eventually killed for their claim. And it's been said by one writer that for the apostles to die for something that they knew was a lie would be simply a psychological impossibility. And I would agree with that. So, secondly, I think you will become personally convinced that the apostles were not lying when you read their letters. These were men whose lives were built on the very highest standard of moral teaching. Everywhere they went, they taught that people should live lives of purity, truth, honesty, reality. Even a cursory reading of the New Testament letters, I think, will convince you that these people were completely sincere in what they were saying. So the idea that they've made the story up to deceive people, I think, is really takes a great deal of faith. And I don't think any serious scholar today actually says that. Okay, so briefly, I'm going to sum up the reasons why I think we can have a very high level of confidence in the records about Jesus in the New Testament. Firstly, the early dating. It's much too early for legendary development. It's within the lifetimes of eyewitnesses who would have been around to confirm or disconfirm the stories. Oh, sorry, Warren, you can take that off. That's not supposed to be there. Secondly, there are multiple accounts. The Gospels we have in the Bible seem to be drawn from 5 independent sources. In addition to this, we have the letters of Paul, the letters of Peter, the letters of John. There's no case of one person just making a wild claim. This is consistent and independent testimony, which forms a very powerful case for the reliability of the claims. It goes far beyond the level of detail and consistency that we have about any other figure from that period of history in the ancient world. And in fact, in most of ancient history, if historians had even 2 sources speaking about the same event, they're usually confident that this event is historical. In the New Testament, we have such an abundance of independent sources that go so far beyond any other historical record of the time that we really can be very confident in the reliability of the New Testament. I'm going to skip ahead a bit. I'm sorry, I went a bit overboard on the details. I hope it's not too much. If we take the view that the New Testament is basically reliable, which I hope I've gone some way to showing, we can then ask the second question, and this is the really important question. It's the question we started with. Who is Jesus? But specifically, I want to ask, who did Jesus say he was? What was his own claims about himself? Could we have... Yes, we'll have this one, thanks. So this is in John 14. Jesus makes the claim, I am the way and the truth and the life. No one comes to the Father except through me. If you really knew me, you would know my Father as well. From now on, you do know him and have seen him. Now, this is a radical thing to say. I wonder if we sometimes lose sight of how astonishing this claim is. Can we see the next slide? And the next one. Thank you. I've just made a little list of just some of the things that he said about himself. You can look them up. Sorry, I didn't reproduce them. John 7:37, Jesus says, if anyone is thirsty, let him come to me and drink. He's claiming to be the answer to the deepest need of the human heart. In Matthew 11:28, Jesus claims to be able to give rest to the soul. In Mark 2:5, Jesus claims to be able to forgive sins, which is something that the people of the day knew only God could do. It gets even more radical in John 8:58. Jesus claims to have existed before Abraham. This is some 2,000 years previously. And then in the same sentence, he says, before Abraham was born, I am. If you know much about the Old Testament, you'll know that I am is the name that God gives to himself. So Jesus is taking the very name of God on his own lips. In Matthew 21:31-46, Jesus claims to be the one who's going to judge every person. And in John 18:37, Jesus says he's the king. He is a king from another world, from a different place. And in Matthew 28:17, he says he has kingly power and authority over the whole universe. So there are very good reasons to believe in Jesus, what has been called his radical self-identity. Jesus believed these things to be true about himself. And the great writer C.S. Lewis said this, I'm sure you've heard this before. Looking at the claims of Jesus, he says, a man who was merely a man and said the sort of things Jesus said would not be a great moral teacher. He would be either a lunatic on the level with a man who says he is a poached egg, or he would be the devil of hell. You must make your choice. Either this man was and is the Son of God, or else a madman or something worse. But let us not come up with any patronizing nonsense about his being a great human teacher. He has not left that open to us. He did not intend to. So C.S. Lewis is presenting us with what's been called his trilemma, three possibilities. Either Jesus is a deceiver, or he's deceived himself, or actually his claims are true. He can't see any other way it could be. And if you can think of any other options, let me know, because I can't think of any others either. So let's look at those. Was he a deceiver? If his claims were not true, and he knew it, essentially Jesus would be asking people to commit their lives to him and to follow and actually give their lives for him as the divine Messiah, knowing full well that he was not. If this is so, then as C.S. Lewis says, Jesus is certainly not a good moral teacher. He is a horrible deceiver. And if this is true, I don't want to have anything to do with him, and I don't think you should either. But I think this explanation won't stand. It's like the suitcase. If you explain Jesus as a deceiver, you need to do even more explaining somewhere else. If we look at his teaching, the Sermon on the Mount, we see literally the highest moral standards the world has ever been given. Love your enemies, turn the cheek, turn the other cheek, pray for those who persecute you. And in his life, we see how he lived these things out, how he cared for people, dealt gently with prostitutes and sinners, healed people, fed the hungry. And on the cross, he says, as he's being nailed onto the cross at that moment, he says, Father, forgive them, for they do not know what they do. I think just from reading the Gospels, you can say confidently that Jesus may be many things, but he's certainly not a deliberate deceiver. And no one actually does say this, do they? I've never heard anyone make that claim. It's just so far from all of the evidence, and it's just completely unfeasible. So we push down the suitcase in one place, but a bump pops up again in another place. If he wasn't a deceiver, maybe he was deceived himself. And that seems to me more reasonable. It seems certain that Jesus did believe these things to be true about himself. He wasn't playing games. He wasn't joking. That he had the authority to forgive sins, that he was the promised Messiah, that he would judge the world at the end of time, that he existed before Abraham. He believed them. And if when you read the Gospels, something rises up within you saying, he really believes this. This is outrageous. He must be completely mad. Delusions of grandeur. Completely deluded. Then I think you are tracking with Jesus. You are hearing what he's saying. I think while you say he was a good man, he was a good moral teacher, you are not hearing what he's saying. But when you hear, when what he's saying starts to sound to you to be completely crazy, you're close to understanding who he is. And I think if Jesus isn't God, he is the greatest lunatic the world has ever known. No exaggeration there. But how likely is it that Jesus was deluded? In one sense, we're now approaching a point where it's really up to you to decide. We've narrowed it down from a lot to two choices, I think. Either he was completely mad or what he was saying was true. And at this point, I don't think I can really offer watertight arguments to convince you. Because becoming convinced about Jesus' identity, ultimately, I think, is something you have to come to for yourself. I think Jesus wants to convince you himself. I would say, just read the Gospels and ask questions. Are these the actions and words of a deluded man? I think he wants to personally convince each one of us. But there are several reasons why I think it's hard to believe that Jesus is delusional. His knowledge, whenever he speaks, he seems to have such balance, such poise, such intelligence. Like the example of paying taxes to Caesar. I don't know if you remember that story. The Pharisees tried to trap him with a dilemma, and his answer is so incisive. It just shows these are not the words of an unhinged man. This is a keenly balanced mind. I've already mentioned the Sermon on the Mount, his way of treating people, not to mention his fulfillment of prophecies, which I won't go into. I would say overall the balance, poise of his life, the way he affected people, makes it incredibly hard to say he was mentally ill. Very difficult. Not to mention the eyewitness testimony of his resurrection, which is a whole nother hour's talk, which I'd love to go into. There was no body in the tomb. The disciples were willing to die for the belief that they had seen him risen. There was no reason for them to believe in the resurrection of Jesus, given their Jewish matrix of thought. They weren't expecting it. I think all of these things just add up to show it's incredibly unlikely that Jesus was delusional. It just doesn't seem to add up. And in my experience, there's been no way to make sense of Jesus, and I've tried. I'm a very skeptical person by nature. I suppose I came to faith slowly and unwillingly, in one sense. I've tried to make sense of Jesus outside of his radical claims about himself being true, but I don't think there's any way to do it. And I think that we're left with the most fearsome and astonishing alternative of all, which is that he actually is who he claims to be. And this is perhaps more radical than any of us realize, because if Jesus is God, then it really does change everything. If he really claims to have absolute authority over your life in every area, then that's big. If he really is the one who is the source of life, who alone can satisfy your soul as a created being, if he really is your maker, the maker of the universe, the one who holds everything together, if he really died so that you and I could come into a relationship of love with him in which we actually get to meet with the living God of the universe, which will heal us of our brokenness and will save us from a lost eternity without God, then this is more significant than we could ever imagine. I began by saying that according to the modern view, the view of Jesus as God was a creation, a legend, and was simply a crutch, a helpful fiction, so that people could feel that their lives have meaning. And I think this is really what we're faced with today, that the Christian story is a comfortable fable. It would be nice if it was true, but really there's no reason to believe it so. Actually, I want to suggest to you that it's the other way around. The modern view, which paints Jesus as merely a good teacher, despite all the evidence, that is the comfortable myth. Because this Jesus is incapable of challenging us. He cannot do anything to us or anything for us. It's the Jesus of the New Testament, the Jesus of the earliest records, the Jesus of the eyewitnesses. It's the real Jesus who is uncomfortable. He's scary. He threatens my deep commitment to be the ruler of my own life and the center of my own universe. But he also offers to give joy, peace, and wholeness in a restored relationship with the maker of the world to anyone who will come to him. It's this Jesus, the real Jesus, who, if we are willing to honestly encounter him, will turn our lives upside down. And that's been my experience, and it's been the experience, I think, of many people here. So, if you're curious or you're not sure what you think about Jesus and Christianity, I hope you might be inspired to read the Gospels, ask questions, come back next week, and I hope that we can journey together as we look together into who Jesus Christ really is. So thanks, Tim, if you can.